Let's call a, let the record reflect that this In-State Energy Committee was convened at exactly 7:30 a.m. February 28th, 2013. The following members are present today: Senator Regan, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Bishop. I'd also like to let the record reflect Senator Dyson is here with us today. Senator Giesel is with us in the audience today. Welcome, Senator. And Senator Coghill will be back in a little bit. He's at another meeting. We had a conflict, and it's my pleasure. I'd like to also recognize our staff today, Christopher Dickrell and Lori Berg, our LIO moderator, my committee staff, Pete Fellman. Again, all cell phones off. And it's a great honor and a pleasure to introduce Governor Bill Sheffield and Joe Griffith from MEA. And the governor's here to talk about in-state gas lines, and Joe will be talking about the state of the rail belt electrical system. And first we're going to hear from the governor and Sheffield, and then Joe Griffith. But before we get started, I'm going to take just 1 second of literary license and privilege of the chair to tell just one quick little story about Governor Sheffield. He beat me in a boat race 30 years ago on the Tanana River, and I could only get as close as second place to him, but I just got to say he's the only governor that ever got in the Yukon 800 race boat and raced to Nenana and back. So a lot of moxie there, Governor. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I didn't know you were going to be a senator, and I'm going to be before you when I beat you. But so I apologize. Things do happen and go around. Good morning, and I thank you for allowing me to speak to the committee this morning on an important subject. This is the second presentation I'm making in about a 28 presentation tour around the state of Alaska. And so I'm here to talk about the future this morning and what we can do for the present and future citizens of Alaska. We are on the precipice of, and in many communities, already over the edge of an energy crisis in Alaska. And too many of our residents are struggling to deal these days with bills to heat their homes and cook their meals, and that add up to the price of a monthly mortgage payment. And it's only going to get worse. We all know that what bush communities have to pay for these basic comforts. We all know what Fairbanks is having to put up with at the present time, and that people are burning so much firewood for heat that the air quality is seriously compromised. And we all know that the deadline in natural gas production from Cook Inlet has caused a loss of hundreds of jobs on the Kenai Peninsula and will drive up domestic and commercial energy costs in just a couple of years. We have the solution before us. It's the in-state gas pipeline. We can bring gas from the tremendous reserves already proved, and probably as much or more than that will be proved up in the future. This is something we can do if we just muster the political will to do it. Doing so will not only benefit the present population through construction and operational job creation, and will benefit our state's children and grandchildren through lower energy costs as well. The acronym for the solution is ASAP, shorthand for the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, commonly referred to as the Bullet Line. It could bring natural gas to Fairbanks, which would greatly reduce the city's increasing air quality problems almost immediately upon delivery. It could also allow Flint Hills Refinery in Fairbanks to return to full production and eliminate its need to import expensive product. It could bring more affordable energy to many rural communities. On the map, you can see as the pipeline comes down, you got Livengood, possible gold mine, and you got a Yukon River, a lot of villages on the river. And so it could bring affordable energy to many rural communities, many of which now must depend on barging in increasingly expensive diesel fuel from the lower 48. It could make the proposed Donlin gold mine more economically viable. And when you get to Donlin Creek, you're about 100 miles away from Bethel, where there's 20,000 people live. It could cut the operating costs of the Alaska Railroad, which, as its former chief executive officer and now a member of the board of directors, I'm very familiar with. The railroad is an icon of Alaska and such importance to both Alaska tourism and its industrial economy, and it should not be jeopardized by energy cost. Just to ad lib just a little bit here, I want to explain that. Flint Hills only operates one stack out of their three stacks at the refinery. It's over above my pay grade to know all about a refinery, but I do know that they don't make any money when the price of oil gets over a certain amount of money, and they're heating their plant with oil, and then they put it back in the line. They pay extra cost to put it back in the line. So with the situation the way it is, they used to send 130 rail cars a day down to the port of Anchorage with product. Some of the product was jet fuel for the Anchorage airport, some was car gasoline and naphtha that they shipped to South America and Asia and wherever 2 times a month. Now they ship 20 cars a day, 5 days a week, and that's all. And so, of course, the railroad hurts for the lack of business. It was their largest customer. But they would fire that plant up again if they had cheap gas. And they could. And all we're doing now is importing jet fuel from the Anchorage airport from Asia and Seattle, and car gasoline coming up from the lower 48 for the south central area. We're just transferring jobs all over the world, and we don't have them ourselves. It doesn't make any sense. It could cut the operating costs for many other businesses of every stripe that cut the wide swath across our economy and greatly affects what consumers have to pay for products and services. It might also make possible the reopening of the Agri plant. It's on the screen up there now, down on the Kenai Peninsula, where 325 jobs disappeared when Cook Inlet gas supplies began to shrink. You can't hardly create jobs like that with a program unless you have something like this. And with Cook Inlet gas supplies, barring some future large discovery diminishing every year, we're looking to possibility of having to import gas for our utilities in the state's largest city within just a couple of years. With all those problems, possible problems, resolved in an in-state gas line, how can we possibly not go forward with it? We have 35 trillion cubic feet of proven gas reserves on the North Slope, and I've yet to meet anyone who knows anything about oil and gas who doesn't believe that there is much more out there yet to be discovered. I truly believe that all we need now is a political will to get the job done. We've talked the big diameter gas line to death for going on 40 years. Maybe it will get done eventually, but the advent of fracking has flooded the gas market in the lower 48, and it's obvious the whole basis of that project has to be rethought. Meanwhile, the Alaska Gas Development Corporation, AGDC, has advanced this ASAP prospect by leaps and bounds since it was assigned the task. Governor Parnell and AGDC President Dan Fauske and his staff working on this project to be commended for the progress that they've made. The environmental studies show significant work in progress. The right-of-way for the pipeline is all but secured. Financing can be arranged one way or another. I would like to see us pay for it outright in order to reduce tariffs and therefore the end-user cost as much as possible. With declining oil production and the state possibly needing to draw on its reserve amounts to operate government and provide public services, I know that view might not prevail. So as the saying goes, the devil's in the details. But I'm convinced we can fight our way past the devils and get this project done. There is certainty about one thing. The longer we avoid making a decision to go forward, the more expensive this project will get. AGDC predicts that every year of delay will raise the cost by $200+ million. And even if we were set to go tomorrow, it'll take 4 years to secure the necessary remaining permits, complete engineering and design before construction could begin. I'm not picking on the large diameter pipeline project, but it's a good example of the cost of delay. When we first started talking about it, it was said to be a $25 billion project, and then it's $30 billion, and on and on. The latest number published last week shows the project costs in a range of $45 to $65 billion. The point is, we have an obvious and increasingly critical need for in-state gas. We have the means to finance the in-state pipeline, no matter the approach. And we have an obligation to our current and future generations of Alaskans to make productive use of our resources. I have no doubt we can do this if we just muster the political will to provide the necessary interim funding to get the job started and ultimately done. And make no mistake, we have plenty of work to be done. We have to get to open season. To get to all that important stage when Alaskans know once and for all that a project is going ahead, AGDC needs to have the support now. AGDC needs the legislation that gives them the tools to hold a successful open season and then to follow through on the commitment to build Alaska's gas pipeline. The more tools AGDC has now, the more likely they are to draw serious, solid commitments from gas buyers and gas sellers. Governor Parnell said it well in his State of the State message addressed this January when he singled out AGDC legislation as a priority, and the bill would add horsepower to ADC's engine. So that's why it's so important to fund the cost of getting this project even further down the road. Part of that will enable us to secure permits. Part of it will enable our public officials to settle on the expected cost to provide answers to all the questions that Alaskans have, and as well they should. So if they can accomplish those tasks by the end of 2014, we would have a year to get contracts in place in order to start procurement and construction by 2017 or 2016. And have gas to Fairbanks and Anchorage by 2019. And I need to mention for the record that I am neither an investor nor have any interest in the operational role in this project. I have been an Alaskan for more than 60 years now, and I care deeply about the present and future needs of this state. I believe it's time to quit studying and get on with investing in its very viable prospect of providing affordable energy that will better the lives of our fellow Alaskans. And I thank you for allowing me to speak today.
Thank you, Governor. Your words were well spoken and taken to heart, and I appreciate you coming here and sharing your wisdom with the group. And I'd encourage questions from the committee. The single most important thing do you think that this state needs to do today? Do you think this is it?
A lot of people, a lot smarter than I am, that have been in high offices around the country, say the most important thing a state can do is build its infrastructure and maintain it and provide education. We've We've done some good work on education, but we haven't taken care of our infrastructure. You know, until you have infrastructure, and I think the state should provide it, then the private sector can come in and take that infrastructure and do things, make things. You can make low sulfur diesel out of gas. You can make compressed gas for trucks and buses, and you can make some other products right here in Alaska and ship them out to other places. And instead of us shipping them raw gas at a cheap price and then buying that stuff back, and we don't have the jobs. I say that gas is for Alaskans and oil is for the state budget. I think it's the most important project we could do.
Thank you. Questions, gentlemen? Senator Merchiki, and I'd like to let the record reflect that Senator Coghill and Senator Merchiki have joined us here about 15 minutes ago. Thank you. Senator Merchiki, question.
Governor, I agree with you. I mean, one of the reasons I'm down here is I've been frustrated. I talked about the fact that I heard eerily similar comments about the gas pipeline when I had pimples. I'm 51 this year. That's a long time. And I do think it's a key issue for the state. What I ask Alaskans to do is just step back fairly and evaluate the options. Parochialism is a big problem in our state, and folks have a hard time getting past what it'll take to get a gas line going. But one thing I do say is the visionaries that built the TAPS line and pushed it through are the folks that created the economy of the state. And I do think we could have a number two industry. Second, we open the valve, no matter what size diameter it is. I mean, we're missing the boat. We have for a long time. What we have to help people understand is, you know, it's just like in your 401k. It's not about timing the market. It's about time in the market. And if you think about the roller coaster of commodity prices, we've missed some very high price opportunities, and there'll be some low price challenges. But when you average the value of a project over a generation or 30 or 40 years, you come out on top. And I agree with you. I certainly hope we can work to get folks in this building. If a large diameter line is going to happen, it needs to happen now, soon. And if not, we need to get behind another option. There's just too many Alaskans that are in need, and too many jobs that are being missed. And it's just not the large industry sector. There are many, aside from mines and things, there are many mom-and-pop opportunities that simply the margins don't work when you're trying to drive a project with diesel. So I do hope we move forward, and very much appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you for those comments. Mr. Chairman, if I could respond to that, that's why it's so important that we get the funding together, and I know you got a few dollars sitting around and that was set aside last year. It's so important to get into open season. We're never going to know anything beyond what we know now until we get into open season. Open season is where all these decisions are made. The oil companies supplying our pipeline with the proper amount of fuel over a long period of time, the size of the pipe, all the questions that people have answered, all those things are important, and they need to have the tools to do it. That's why I'm talking about House Bill 4, it's just so important that happen now, before you lose another year, is to get that open season started.
Thank you, Governor. Any other comments? If not, Governor, it's a pleasure. Thanks for coming in front of the committee. At this point, we're going to take a brief at ease to let our next presenter get ready to go. Back to order. Mr. Griffith, put your name on the record and introduce your staff if you so choose, and the floor is yours, sir.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for inviting me. My name is Joe Griffith. I'm the general manager of Matanuska Electric, also the CEO for ArcTech, the Rail Belt G&T. To my left is my associate and staff member, Denali Daniels, who knows how to operate these things, and that's the reason she's sitting here, so we don't fumble the ball. Appreciate your staff's help in putting this together. Also, I have a board member sitting here, Janet Kincaid, a highly interested woman from Palmer, and I believe she's running Palmer these days, so certainly she's running me. Senator Egan has something. Thank you, sir. I must start with a couple of anecdotes also. First, I'll start with an anecdote about how I first met the governor that just spoke to you. I was commander at Elmendorf Air Force Base back just shortly after he was elected, and when a dignitary arrived at the installation, I always got a call, and I would go meet them if their staff didn't or something. I got a call one afternoon that said the governor's coming in a C-12. That was a National Guard C-12, so I ran down to got in my car and drove down to the base ops, and I got there just as the C-12 was pulling off. It was a cold day, about 20 below zero. The wind was blowing on the flight line, something awful. And they set the governor out on the ramp about 100 yards from base ops and taxied off. So, and he was standing there looking around. No staff, nobody else there. So that's how I got to learn to meet the governor, and we've been friends, genuine friends, ever since. Secondly, I used to work for Senator Dyson, and those were hard, hard days. He's a demanding taskmaster, and I trust that he will understand all of these things that we're going to talk about here today. And I'm glad to see you're in here, Fred. Thanks for coming. I've spent 25 years or so in this business, the energy business. I spent 17 years at Chugach, and the last four or five as the CEO of Chugach. After a hiatus of a couple of 3 years, I went out to MEA, and I've been there for the last 3 years. And we have exciting things underway there. Can we figure out how to... The Rail Belt is made up of four private organizations, and you hear a lot of words about the private sector. If we just had a private sector, four of the co-ops that run the electrical system in the Rail Belt are private. There are two munis, and they're publicly owned, but we all operate about the same way. That's Anchorage MLMP, Chugach, Golden Valley, Homer Electric, Matanuska Electric, and Seward Electric System. All are not for profits, and that's a key factor, particularly when you get to deciding what your future power costs are going to be. It is affected by the type of organization you are. We're going to talk about what the parts of an electrical electrical system are. There's generation, and then you have to transmit the generated electricity to the distribution systems. So you end up with three pieces in the system: the generation, the transmission, and the distribution. Distribution is what delivers it to your businesses. I hope you have the ability to see this chart up there, because that does lay out the whole... Oh, you've got it up here. Good. If you can see that well. I hope you can. And I'll break them down in pieces. Generation is pretty straightforward, and I will cover that in just a moment. The transmission system is the one we're concentrating on these days in the Rail Belt. It connects all of the utilities together. It facilitates economic dispatch of power. Economic dispatch means that you bring the cheapest machines online first to operate, and you step up to the higher cost ones as the load develops and builds. and the load shifts all the time. Minute by minute, the load changes. It's never stable and steady. It facilitates power transfers. In fact, MEA today buys all of its power short of Bradley Lake and a little bit from the Glutna Hydro facility from Chugach, who delivers it through part of that transmission system you see in front of you there. It also permits reserve sharing. Now, why is that important? Because you must have online reserves, spend, if you will, available that you can switch to if you lose a line or generation or what have you. There are two ways to deal with that. One, you can have the equipment on the line to save it, and this is what Fairbanks did with the battery energy system that they have up there, is they precluded having to go into the dark every time the line tripped off between Anchorage and Fairbanks. And a lot of power over the last 20 years has been sold over that line. And the reserve factor for Fairbanks was always that battery. Why was that important? It gave them time, the 20 minutes or so that they needed to bring up a frame 7 and pick up the load that they had lost by virtue of the transmission line failure of some. Reserve sharing is worth, this power transfer and reserve sharing is worth billions of dollars a year to the utilities. You never see those numbers, but you would see them immediately in your bill if we couldn't do it. All the utilities have or soon will have their own generation capability. The investment by the utilities is about $1 billion right now. That's no small sum. Chugach has the Beluga plant that's been around for many, many years. South Anchorage plant is the new one they put online at the 1st of February. IGT is an old plant at the headquarters. Cooper Lake Hydro is the hydro facility on the Kenai Peninsula, small one, 22 megawatts, I believe. And the Iklutna. Oh, thank you. The Iklutna. Man, I'm doing all right here today. You got board members delivering water to me. That's pretty good. MLNP has Plant 1 and 2. Plant 1 is downtown Ship Creek area, and Plant 2 is out on the Glen Highway. They also own the major portion of the Iklutna hydroelectric facility that's out in just at the little bit above the Connect Arm Bridge on the Glen Highway. Golden Valley has a plethora of generation. They've got the North Pole plant, the Eva Creek Wind that just recently started production. The Healy Coal plant's a 25 megawatt unit that they are currently operating, and they're working to bring on the Healy Clean Coal plant that has been dormant for about the past 10 years. They also buy the output of Aurora in downtown Fairbanks, and that's a contract basis with Usabelli. They have the battery energy storage system, and that I just mentioned to you why they built that and what it does. And the battery system is like a spring in a mechanical device. It allows changes without having to do something with a throttle on a gas turbine or a reciprocating engine. They have a Zunder plant and a small plant at Delta that they also own. Their transmission system connects all of these together. MEA is building the Iklutna Generation Station. That's my project. And we own a piece of the Iklutna Hydro facility. Homer has the Nikiski combined cycle plant. That's at Nikiski. That was originally put in there to provide heat. It was a combined heat and power plant, and to provide heat through a boiler using exhaust waste heat from a frame 6 at one time that was the most efficient unit in the rail belt. Now they have added a boiler onto that and a steam turbine, and that will increase the output. They're also building a plant at the old Soldotna site, right, the substation just to the east of the town. And they did purchase Bernice Lake, an old plant from Chugach recently. Seward has one small facility that at some point will be able to seamlessly switch back and forth between their own operation and picking up Chugach power on the transmission system. They're not quite there yet, but they're getting there. And all of the above, as I mentioned, own a part of Bradley Lake. That's why the high interest in Bradley Lake. It's the least expensive large power supply in the state of Alaska. Well, here's the situation in the Rail Belt. Gas is a problem. And the reason we have such a high interest in it is you can never let your gas system fail. If it ever fails, the price of trying to fix it is prohibitive, and literally, if it occurred in the winter, and that's when it would likely occur, you would freeze up everything that didn't have the heat available. So we in the electric industry will have to protect the gas system. We also use gas for our own generation. The new generation changes that are occurring because of the $1 billion investment that I just mentioned changes the lay of the land and the ability to dispatch power over the transmission system in the whole rail belt from Fairbanks to Homer. It's principally driven by the fact that Beluga will no longer be running in load following mode. It will probably become a peaking plant, and it won't be there as the buffer between the load along the rest of the rail belt, a large power source in the middle of the rail belt, and Bradley Lake. Today, it's Chugach for 25 years has done that role, and they will no longer be able to do it when Homer's generation facilities are online on the Kenai, and the new Iqaluit plant comes up, and their own South Anchorage plant changes the lay of the land. And my statement always regarding electrical power is that the economy demands reasonably priced power. Any successful modern economy has to have economically priced power.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Just give me the time frames on the Iqaluit and the other one down in Homer. What's the time frame for them coming online?
Homer's, I believe they're running the Kiski now, or at least shaking it down. So that is already online. I would guess they're 6 months away from being online with the Soldotna facility, maybe more. They had some difficulties with an exhaust stack, and they're in the process of fixing that. So we have, let's say we have a year to get away with this, and the real problem will occur when the Iqaluit plant, the one I'm building, comes online, because that will shut down a portion of Beluga. It won't be there to act as the buffer for Bradley Lake sales coming north. So I think we're a year and a half away from having a real problem to deal with. And that's unfortunately inadequate time to fix the transmission system. So we're still going to have to do some heroics to make all this work.
With the Healy Clean Coal Power be coming on about that time.
Yes.
Does that help with the stability at all?
Well, it helps Fairbanks, certainly. That adds 50 megawatts to
Fairbanks. Not coming south.
Well, it could. It could come south, most assuredly. And if we had a problem down here, then undoubtedly, and in fact, in the recent past, we have imported power from Golden Valley. So it'll come down the line just as well as it'll go north. That's the nature of electricity. It's not like plumbing.
Mental picture of your time framing.
Yeah. Well, the crisis we face is fuel and transmission congestion, and all in the near term. 3 to 5 years, we've got to do something to save ourselves here.
Maybe I'll get ahead of you a little bit, but the first project, it sounds to me like it's from Bradley Lake going north into Anchorage.
That's the first one we're asking credit for through the chair, yes. But I assure you, Senator Coghill, the problem is equally problematic from Anchorage to Fairbanks. And when you bring Healy Clean Coal on, it gets to be a little more tricky. So we have to deal with all of these. And then in the long run, you've got Wautana that you have to deal with. You have to be able to transmit power of that magnitude both directions, and today we can't do that.
I'm just trying to get a mental picture, and I know those are big dollar items. I know the Anchorage North is about a $200 million project. What's the Homer to Anchorage project generally?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, depending on how you choose to approach it and the level of reliability, and that's a bit of a skate on answering your question directly, I can give you the total number to fix it perfectly, but I don't think we could ever afford that. The proposals actually go back to 1993 when there was the proposed northern intertie and the proposed southern intertie. We never built the southern intertie. Golden Valley did build the northern intertie from Healy to Wilson, I believe it went. So to resolve the entire Bradley constraint issue and to permit the ability to do what's called hydro-hydro coordination between Wautana and Bradley Lake probably is a billion-dollar challenge. We can get by cheaper, and I think that's how we will approach it, certainly, is you won't fix it entirely. You will accept some degree of what's called load shed, and which gives you time then to bring up other generation. We will have sufficient generation on the system to cover our needs. It may be expensive, and you may have to have some kind of blackout process if you lose these lines, particularly to the big generation sources. If you put a second line to Beluga that is proposed by a study that was conducted last summer, underwater high voltage DC line to Beluga, that really gives you near 100% reliability on the southern sector. It further lets you take one of the lines out for service. Today, if you take it out, any of the lines out for service, you're down on delivering Bradley Lake power. So we just pond the water. And there comes a point, if you can't deliver, that it goes over the dam, and then that's, of course, lost.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, one other thing. With your high-voltage DC, what is the integration cost acceptable when you go across the inlet?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, yes, we believe it is. It's equivalent to what it costs today to put in AC overhead lines, and it's a single line, essentially, large cable that would carry both sides of the DC circuit. The costly part of a DC circuit is the conversion process on each end, but they are looking a lot better.
Thank you. All right, great. Yeah, I'm just trying to go back off my memory, not that it makes any difference, but was it Tesla and Westinghouse was arguing over AC-DC?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it was. And it was Nikola Tesla that pushed hard for DC. In those days, it was considered unsafe to have AC power because it will electrocute you. DC will too, but it's just less inclined to do that. There was a lot of difference in the size of the equipment then. Today, we know we've got solid-state devices that can solve that problem for us that they did not have in those days.
But I think Tesla's on the right track because you can move DC cheaper, more of it cheaper.
You can move more of it cheaper. You don't face what's called the VAR problem, and I'm not even going to try to explain that to you. If you're not an electrical engineer, you're probably not even interested in it. But AC systems resist the movement because of their cyclic problem. And that creates losses in the line, and it costs you money to make that happen. DC does not exhibit that. And it's you don't have to have special equipment to get the line up to speed where it will transmit even. Now, they do work, and we know today how to make it work. It just costs quite a bit, and it takes a big facility on each end. First to make the DC and second, because we don't generate and we don't deliver it out of our generators at in DC, it's AC. Thank you for those questions. I love talking about those kind of things. The utilities have, Mr. Chairman, a fuel situation mitigation effort underway. We're looking hard at the near-term fixes. This again is 3 to 5 years, and that's where the difficult period is. You heard the governor speak of having a pipeline by 2019. Sure, that would solve the problem outright. and I think all we have to do there is be sure we've got a way to get it off the pipeline and a way to market it so it is economic for the people who are selling the gas. It appears that the costs are going to be prohibitive for importation of gas in the near term. Don't know that for certain yet, but my look at the numbers says it is. And you heard the governor speak about ASAP's deliveries, but 2019, that didn't do a thing for us between now and 2019. So we have to fill that gap. North Slope trucking is a concept that's being looked at. Probably could help Fairbanks. It won't do a thing for South Central because it's a project beyond building the pyramids. I calculated the number of trucks, and I think I came up with about 500 trucks running 24/7 up and down the Parks Highway. So it's just there are better ways to do it. Doesn't mean it won't work for Fairbanks. It doesn't mean it wouldn't work to solve the air problem as well as the home and business heating problem in Fairbanks once you build out your delivery system. Watana, not till 2024. And we still have a lot of work necessary on the transmission system to make all of that work. So my guess is that the least cost approach in the near term is going to be some of us to generate with diesel fuel for at least part of the time and just hope that, and I wrote a book once called Hope is Not a Strategy, but here I am hoping it is, that Cook Inlet gas supply improves, and I'm optimistic that that will happen. Other short-term things that help is this decongestion of the transmission system to facilitate better use of Bradley Lake. And that is a big one because Bradley Lake, a good share of the time, can carry the load during the summer when there is, we're not using as much energy. Bradley Lake is a good one to use. And that's what ARCTEC and AEA are working at right now. And that's the request in the little booklet we've handed out around the building and that my board member here keeps giving each one of you. And each version is better, so look at the date in the corner. I've got it down now to where it's anybody can understand it. It makes a lot of sense. We need more gas storage capability.
Before we go any further, can I ask something on Bradley?
Yes, sir.
I understand there's going to be an upgrade, or it's in the works, for getting more spill from Bradley. Is that going to be beneficial with that transmission upgrade?
Yes. Through the chair, Senator Coghill, we don't use the term spill ever in hydro facilities because spill means you lost it. Okay. But it diverts the Battle Creek watershed that currently dumps into the east side. It would put it into Ketchumack Bay. And that will add upwards of 45,000 megawatt hours in a good water year. We will be able to get that power out. I don't mean to say that even with the existing system we can't deliver it. It's just that you can't deliver it when you need it most. So you'll have to go through some fancy machinations to shut down generation that would otherwise be running to get your Bradley Lake power out, and who needs it at midnight type thing. Mm-hmm. So that's the wrinkle that's evident in that. But you will see in a moment on a slide of the ARCTEC request that Battle Creek diversion is in there today.
Diversion, not spill. I got it.
Diversion, not spill. Yes, sir. Thank you. We need, as I said, natural gas storage capability. We have CENGSA. It can handle 11 or 12 BCF today, and that's saved us in December, actually, when they couldn't get the gas, so they were able to pull from CENGSA and keep the system where it should have been. But it needs more capacity out of there or somewhere else.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding is there's a need for this over on the Beluga side. Are you familiar with the technical aspects of that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, yes, I am. And my plant will be on the Beluga side because that's where the pipeline is. And I am actively talking with people over there who have storage capability today, either to buy, rent, or however we can get that storage. We need a buffer over there as well. And there is some capability there. I just don't, not sure how much. Hillcorp has some, and Aurora west of Tyonek has, I believe, one BCF they can store.
I could just follow up, Mr. Chair. Does that help MLMP and Chugach to have more storage on the Beluga side?
It could, because you can reverse the pipeline will flow either way. The so-called SIGS pipeline, Cook Inlet Gas Gathering System pipeline, runs between Tyonek and Nikiski. And if something were to happen, some cataclysmic event that closed down the pipelines on one side, the east side, Kenai, you could actually move gas this way on that pipeline.
We're good?
Thank you. Cheaper diesel fuel. How do you get cheaper diesel fuel? The state owns a lot of royalty oil, and if push came to shove, could use that royalty oil to make it less expensive diesel. And I'm not going to get into all the legalities of it. We've talked about it for, well, since we created the state and our Constitution. There are those who say such would violate Article 8. I don't happen to be one of them. I think it's for the general good of the people. And it, at the same time, could help the situation that we have in the rural areas. We need to continue to foster Cook Inlet development. Hillcorp claims they're going to try to do it, as do many others. The problem is they've got to have a market. And if we don't keep an LNG exportation facility open, then we're all in the oil business, not in the gas business. And our gas market is not big enough to warrant the kind of searching that needs to be done to ensure that we will have gas in the future. Another option is what I call smaller, cheaper importation of LNG. There are supplies of it in the lower 48 that could be palletized and brought up in, say, 10,000-gallon containers. And we're looking actively at that as an aid to the gas system. It's not a long-term solution. The supply is small, but it's enough that it could help us get over a big hump. Another one is to import propane. British Columbia today is replete in propane, and some of the prices are 58 cents a gallon. So that begins to look interesting. Propane, you can mix with air and put it right into a gas line system. So it's there and available. I know you folks had had a discussion about the IPPs and how they fit in the rail belt system, and I'm particularly adept at speaking to this because I've spent 25 years of dealing with IPPs, and in some cases people who thought that they could produce as cheaply or better than we. There's a federal law called the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, PURPA, it's referred to as, and PURPA requires utilities to accept power, electrical power output for a combined heat and power facility. If the IPPs wish to compete on a head-up basis, my view has always been, come on, bring in your prices, we'll take a look at them, see what you can do. Often they cannot compete with the utilities, the co-op or munis, for reasons that I'll mention in just a moment. But they do have the right to say, I'm going to be a combined heat and power facility, and to then sell you power at what's called avoided cost. There are two kinds of avoided costs, firm versus non-firm. Firm means that they have reserves that back it up. Non-firm means that you just take it when you can, and it's up to you to back it up. And you, as you might imagine, non-firm is a lot less expensive than firm. So most of them say, well, I'll do the combined heat and power approach, and that is a good one if you have a market for the heat, and it will work if you can market your heat. And the idea behind the federal law was that they would be first a heat producer and secondly an electricity producer. They get it the other way around all the time. They want to be an electricity producer and use waste heat. That's not what PURPA is all about. The RCA regulations do mimic PURPA and require the same, for our state, the same business that the federal law requires. The big issue on all of these is rates of return in the economics. The IPPs, investor owns, need 10% or more to be able to make it. We co-ops struggle along with 3 to 5% because we have a captive market and no shareholders. And we can keep their money almost as long as we want, and today it's plus 20 years for all of it. And that's the capital credits checks that you often get in the mail. That's returning some portion of that to you. And that's, yes?
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I've got to run off to another meeting, but with your permission, I'd like to ask Mr. Griffith a couple questions. Joe, I understand that you made a heroic effort to be able to use coal as a fuel for your new plant, and were stymied not by costs or thermodynamics, but the public opinion of the permitting process. Would you rehearse that for us?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, yes, that was the case. Actually, that goes back 10 or 12 years. Brad Evans, who's now CEO of Chugach, and I had conjured up a coal plant philosophy some 10 or 12 years ago at Beluga, mine mouth facility, 25 miles west of Beluga. That would have worked. Politics got in the way of that one. I could not get agreement of the rail belt to build that plant. Had we built that plant, started on it 10 or 12 years ago, we'd be having a whole different discussion here today. The other one in the valley about which you speak was an attempt by MEA to build a coal plant for their needs, the very plant I'm building today at Eklutna, and that became another environmental issue, resulting in a move by the borough to put a very restraining ordinance in place that literally said you can't build a power plant over here. Because of that, MEA moved to the municipality of Anchorage with our plant. That's why it's located in Anchorage, not in the borough, is because of that restrictions put in place to counter the coal plant. So it was most of it politics or environmental points of view.
Yeah, just a couple quick ones. Were you convinced that the stack discharges were within acceptable limits from the technology you were looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, most assuredly. In fact, coal plants are probably cleaner today than any of them because the rules are so tight.
And the last one, our mutual friend Mira is touring the state talking about, I think, what could be viable, and that's a big power generation plant on the North Slope and high voltage DC coming south. Is that close enough to being a potential solution for us that we ought to at least consider it, or is it wild and off the chart?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, no, it's not off the chart. It is entirely feasible, but it has to be fully fleshed out. I can't envision anybody building a transmission line over Attigan Pass. And when I asked the Marsh Creek folks, how do you expect to do that, they said they were going to tunnel under it. Well, that is a possibility, but the costs are got to be high for that. Could it be done? Yes. With redundancy, yes. But you would have to have that much reserve on the south end of it. And if we had the transmission system, we could probably accommodate that. It's essentially ends up being a matter of money. And Mira's point of view today is, well, you need to study it. I agree. We ought to study it. We ought to know those answers. We shouldn't take a single thing off the table till we've got something figured out that works.
And just last thing, who the heck should we have study these several options and risks and costs and cost benefit?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that's one of my favorite questions. And in 1993, I had that same debate in this same building with Ramona Barnes, rest her soul. And she chose to disembowel AEA because of a political spat. In the process, we haven't moved forward one inch, essentially, since then. And that's a lot of the problem we face today was because AEA, who at that time was the holder of the energy policy for the state, and we're doing things. They built the Alaska Intertie, Bradley Lake, the Four Dam Pool, goes on and on. And in some cases dragged us utilities kicking and screaming into the fray, but they made it work for us. We don't have that today. AEA can't even hire people. So they can't step into the leadership role that they need to be. If I were governor, I would have my energy czar sitting at the table with me every day. I'd have breakfast with him. It's so important that we just cannot ignore it. I hope I haven't pontificated
yes.
too much.
So for you all, Joe, I think, was the youngest bird colonel the Air Force ever had. When he took over at Elmendorf, they had a very poor rating and went to number one in the world. Our former Lieutenant Governor Campbell thinks that Joe made him the man who he is. Joe and I, one of those male bonding things, we crash airplanes together. He dropped Representative Keller and I in on the Talkeetna River to salvage a Stinson and bent his hot rod float plane, and the reason his hair is short is I drug him out of the Talkeetna River when it was very, very cold. Anyways, I've got to run. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. I'm sure he's going to write a book on that, Senator.
Yeah. Joe, I'd like to just, Mr. Griffith, I'd just like to dovetail on his comments a little bit, and I'd like to have maybe a further discussion offline if we could get together with my schedule. And
certainly.
I share I think everyone's frustration. How do we get a single point of command and control structure for energy needs in Alaska to take the politics out of it and put good business practices to executing our energy needs and get off this crisis management?
I'm happy to speak on that, Mr. Chairman, at your convenience. And I don't know what we face here time-wise, but I don't think we have enough time to go through that this morning.
Well, we'll let you continue on. Thank you.
Okay. Here's what ARCTEC is requesting to do the previous step that I mentioned, to get Bradley Lake available. The governor has $13.7 million in his budget. We support that. He has $95 million for the Wautana project. We support that. These are AEA projects, incidentally. The Battle Creek diversion is also into a state-owned asset, namely Bradley Lake. Unfortunately, it didn't get into the budget, and I don't know why. I asked both Karen Rehfeld and the governor why it wasn't in there, and neither one of them knew, so they said, you do something heroic. So here I am. I'm asking for $23.5 million to keep that project on schedule. And as I say, it's worth over $3 million a year. And we're also supporting the Renewable Energy Grant Fund increase. The governor has $25 million in his budget for that. AEA believes they need $56 million to keep the program going this year. So we're saying that makes a lot of sense to us because it takes pressure off the rest of the system.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Thank you. Does the Battle Creek diversion, does that, how many megawatts does that add, or what does that do for our system?
It adds, through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it does not add any capacity to Bradley Lake. That's limited by the size of the generators at about 124 nameplate capability. But it does add upwards of 40 to 45,000 megawatt hours of power. Each one of those is worth $50 at the junction box coming out of Bradley Lake, and it offsets power that costs twice that much. So it is a large piece of power.
Can you help explain? I think I might have it, but my friend to my left here refers to peak, so you got more water when you can meet the peak power demand. Is that right?
That's, yes. Okay. It's longer and more should you need. It doesn't necessarily change the lake level. Right. It just means there's more in the lake over a given period over average. So doesn't give you any more capacity. That you're limited by your generators there.
Go ahead, Senator.
How much, how quickly could that be put on, could that project be completed if you got
that this year? Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that project could start work next summer. they could actually start moving dirt, they tell me, by at least fall. And it's a simple diversion. There's no drilling required to speak of. They're just going to blast their way through and move a creek from one flow situation to another with a small dam. Doesn't appear there's any resistance anywhere to it. Most of the studies are done, so it is very feasible and doable, and we don't want to stop it, because if we don't fund it, we lose a year.
A couple questions.
Senator Machicki has a question. A couple.
One question I have for you, Joe, is if you could quantify your optimism for Cook Inlet gas supplies improving. I'm struggling with that comment.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I also have struggled with it for many, many years. But I listened to the experts tell me that there is a lot of gas still out there. We just have to find it. And that is the tall pole in the tent, is finding it. And it takes the most recent study, I think you folks have been briefed on, the PRA study, said you need 16 to 18 wells a year to do that. A well can cost $10 to $20 million, as you know. It's very expensive to get it, but it's worth a lot when you don't, and it's really worth a lot if you don't have it. So, and every one of the independents I talked to, and I've been speaking to them now for ever since they would start talking to me, thinks they have gas and thinks they'll find it. Now, is that the oil man or gas man's optimism that just let me drill another hole? I don't know. The experts say there's gas out there. And if we just search right, and we're doing a lot of good things right now, namely because of state efforts to foster this kind of activity and the tax-based arrangement that we have out there. So I'm trying to remain optimistic, Senator.
I appreciate you saying trying. I mean, you pointed out a couple of key things. We're not drilling enough. We've had three large fields in Cook Inlet supplying the entire basin for 40 years, and I'm not seeing a fourth, not seeing the activity we need to keep up with the decline curve. We've got a natural gas problem.
We do.
And I do hope that there are some discoveries to certainly push out that critical intersection. But you also talk about diesel being the best option, and at 3 to 4 times the cost of natural gas, I'm struggling with that comment as well.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the only reason that is you cannot accept a long-term solution. If you can beat diesel easily, if you will go with a 20-25-year solution to importation. But around this building, that's anathema to even talk about. So if you cram it, all of the capital needs into a 3 to 5 year period, it's no longer a rational approach to things. That's the simple reason for it. So how do you get to 5 years down the road when Cook Inlet's going to have all the gas it needs? You burn diesel when you need to in the interim. There's still a lot of gas out there. We haven't run out yet. It's just that the deliverability issue is huge at times. You just can't pull enough that you need when you need it. And the decline curve is, as you have seen, pretty severe. So we've got to fix all of that. How do you get to that point where somebody's drilling 15 wells a year? You got to burn something else. And too late to build coal. We missed that bus. Too late to build hydro. Takes too long to do that. We're not going to get a gas line from the North Slope in that time period. So what are you left with? Propane? That'll probably beat diesel, but I've still got some work to do on that, and I haven't quit on it. You can burn that in my engines. You can burn it in any one of the gas turbines just fine. We know how to do that. But it also takes some infrastructure to get there. Each of these things is still on the table being ruminated on.
Senator Machicki?
Yeah, my understanding is that there are utilities in Cook Inlet working on a lower-cost, short-term LNG import option. So I understand that is still on the table without long-term.
That is true, and I'm a member of that group. We are actively pursuing it. As I said, we're not taking anything off the table yet, but I just have a feeling that the plant that's going to be able to burn diesel fuel the easiest is mine, because those engines can switch seamlessly between natural gas and diesel, and I have my fuel team looking hard for a less expensive supply of diesel fuel. I think I can beat the local price quite a bit. And every nickel you take off is something you pass directly to your membership.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. And just being cold and dark in the Cook Inlet Basin is not an interest I have. So anything that we can do to help you to keep that from happening is important to all of us.
Thank you, Senator.
Other questions from members? Committee?
Thank you.
I appreciate your presentation, and I'd like to thank your left hand there, I guess, for helping. I know I have to bring mine with me where I go, too, to help with the audio visual. So with that, any other questions of the committee? I would like to thank Governor Sheffield and, again, Joe Griffith for a very informative presentation. There will be no meetings Tuesday, March 5th, or Thursday, March 7th. And without objection, I'd like to bring the meeting to a close.